be ready to stand and sing that song in just a few moments as I present a few comments, mostly from the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew. I generally put my verses up there, but I've started auditing my PowerPoints, and am I putting needless things up there? So this is a pretty lengthy drawing or reading, so I chose not to put that up on the page or the overhead, but we will be reading the first 13 verses of the 25th book or chapter of Matthew. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oils with their lamps. As the bridegroom had delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." So before we begin to dissect and understand this parable, there is some context we can take from it by looking at the end of chapter 24. Matthew 24 starts with Jesus foretelling about the destruction of Jerusalem. And then he transitions towards the end of the chapter to talking about the coming of the, you know, of the Lord on the day of judgment. So from verse 42 of chapter 24 till the end of that chapter, he begins talking about being prepared for his return. So with those verses in chapter 24 kind of as the context for him telling the story, I think we can understand a little bit more about what he's saying here, that this is definitely referencing his return. Now, as the overhead indicates there, I think there are three groups of people that we can learn from reading this parable. We'll begin with the obvious one. The first one is the bridegroom. And now, this clearly is Christ. The bridegroom is a common way of describing him. For instance, in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2, it says, "For I feel a divine jealousy for you, since I betroth you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ." So here we get not only the fact that Jesus is the bridegroom, that he is the husband, but that we all are being prepared for him to be married and betrothed to him. Paul says believers are to be betrothed to this one husband, which is Christ. And in John chapter 3, part of a longer reading, John the Baptist talks about Christ being the bridegroom. In verse 28 of chapter 3 of John, John says he is referencing that he is not, he is not the Christ. And he goes, "But I am a friend to the bridegroom." And the bridegroom is Christ, you know, that he's been speaking about. So he identifies and says, "I'm just the friend of the bridegroom." This role traditionally was set about that in preparation, as preparation for the wedding took place, the friend of the bridegroom was responsible for helping the bridegroom prepare for the wedding. And so this is really an apt description of John the Baptist's role in presenting the bridegroom. John the Baptist came to prepare the way for Christ to come into this world. So it's a very good description that he's describing himself as the friend of the bridegroom and Jesus being the bridegroom itself. So that's one group. I don't think we have any issue understanding their role in this story. The second group are the virgins. Now, for my purposes this morning, I'm going to refer to those that were prepared as the wise five and those who were not prepared as the foolish five. And so the wise five, this is what we know of the bridegroom. They know the bridegroom. They understand that he will be arriving. And they are serious about the focus and their mission and their preparation for this event. Now, the foolish five... Now, the foolish five, they also knew of the bridegroom. They knew that the bridegroom would be coming, but they weren't serious about their preparation for the event. So all 10 had lamps, but only 5, the wise 5, had additional oil. The other 5 had lamps, but they did not bring additional oil. The other 5 did not take this, they really didn't prepare seriously for any contingency. They didn't take the steps necessary to make sure that they would be able to join him. The bridegroom, as the story lets us know, was delayed. And it got to be late in the evening, and all 10 of them did fall asleep. The bridegroom, at midnight, though, does arrive. The 10 get up, and says they start to trim their lamps, and 5 were prepared. They had oil that was be able to get them to where they needed to go, to the feast. The other 5, as we know, did not. They asked the wise 5, "Can you help us out?" And their point was, if we give you some, then none of us will have enough. And so go take whatever steps you need to do to be able to purchase some, to be able to allow you to get there. Now, the wise 5 had no idea that they would not be able to get in after the fact, but they were telling them in good faith to go and purchase more to allow you to arrive there. They left to go find the merchant from whom they could buy this oil. But by the time they returned, the feast had begun. Those who were ready were now inside. The wise 5 who had been prepared are in with the bridegroom and the feast, but the outer door had been shut. These foolish 5 implore to be let in. They want to be with the bridegroom. They want to have joined him, but they were not allowed. That the bridegroom says, "I don't even know who you are. I'm not letting you in." So this parable, especially since it follows the warnings that I referenced at the end of chapter 24, cannot be interpreted in any other way than this is a description of the Lord returning at the end of the age. I think one of the most important observations that we have is that the prepared group did not know when the bridegroom will arrive. They didn't have any kind of heads up. They didn't know something that they didn't share with the other 5. They just knew that they needed to be prepared. Verse 13 provides this context. Like the foolish 5, the wise 5 also slept, and they were not able to know when the bridegroom was coming. If that was the case, we all could be prepared if we know the time and date. They were not able to be prepared because they knew when he'd be arriving. They just knew they needed to be prepared for any contingency. So if we know today when the Lord is coming back, we all could live the way we wanted and then shape up right at the end. But that's not the dynamic that we have. We have to be prepared every day that the Lord could return, and we need to live our lives in such a way to avoid the sins of this world and the temptations of this world, and to live in Christ and be ready to join him at any time. At the time that he does return and we all stand before the judgment, we will be only be able to reflect on what we've done. No one else will be able to help us get into heaven based upon what other people have done. They can't vouch for us or speak for us. We all are going to be judged upon what we've done. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10 reads, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil." Hebrews 9, verse 27 says, "Just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes the judgment." There's no time for preparation after he returns. We're not able to live the way we want to live, and then when he does come, suddenly start believing and acting the way we need to have been living, we have to live our lives that entire way. We have to be prepared. So on the flip side of that, do the prepared have any duty towards the unprepared? First Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 11 reads, "Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing." From this verse here in First Thessalonians, we can understand that Christians are required to try to help those that are unprepared. But ultimately, we can't help them get into heaven, but we need to encourage each other. We need to build each other up and remind each other that we need to be ready for when the bridegroom returns. In this case, when Jesus returns for all of us. We should not be simply satisfied that we are prepared, but we should be trying to help our others. I've been flying a lot lately, and you kind of gloss over when they start giving the safety speech before you take off. I mean, we've all heard it. Anybody who's flown has heard it. But, you know, they talk about, in the case of an emergency, if something, you know, the air mask will drop down from the ceiling of the plane. And they tell you to take care of yourself before you attend to someone who helps. Because if you wait to take care of yourself, you may not be able to help them. I think that's kind of the concept here. If you know you're in good shape, you can then be able to help others. And so that's what's being told here in 1 Thessalonians, that we need to encourage others and we need to build others up. While there's still time, the wise should always be willing to help what are called the foolish. Now, the foolish five neither expected the delay, nor did they anticipate that after they went and bought more oil and finally did arrive, they had no way of knowing that they wouldn't be able to get in. They are, all 10 of them, from what we could tell, are on the same level. They've all been, they all have the same, I don't want to say they're not morally pure, but they all would be welcomed in to the feast. We have no reason to doubt that. But five of them merely had made inadequate provisions for being prepared, and they were insufficient in their preparation, I should say. We should observe that for some period of time, the foolish five were really indistinguishable from the wise five. The foolish five had addressed the groom as Lord twice. They were believers. That is established here. They were all invited to the wedding celebration. They all had come anticipating being able to get in. The five virgins, the foolish five were not different from the wise five, except for one thing. They had no oil for their lamps. They simply did not do all that they could to be prepared. We know it was possible to do more than they did. The wise five were able to get in because they had made the proper steps. But they were able to prepare, and they did not. And because of that, they had no excuse for why they were not prepared. They had every opportunity. We're not told anything. They had to work late, or we're not told anything. They all could have taken the same preparations. Now, we could take this in a way that to show that the church is always going to be a mix of people that are prepared and unprepared. Any of us who have attended here for any amount of time can think of members that used to be here, and that for, you know, they regularly attended, they taught Bible classes, they gave Wednesday night talks, taught classes, but they're not here with us today. Now, a lot of them have moved away, but I think we all can think of people that we know used to be here, and for whatever reason, they've decided to not be among us. And so the church is never going to be a perfect blend of dedicated and properly prepared members. West Carrollton is no exception. That's why those that are prepared, it's so important that we do that encouragement, and that we do support and strengthen and build each other up while we're here to try to prevent that from happening in the future. Now, just someone reading this account might say, well, that was kind of mean that the wise five didn't try to help the other five. But, in the context of their story, like I said, sharing their oil would have meant no one would have gotten in. And so we can learn from the interpretation of this parable that the saved cannot share what they have to help the unsaved. Going back to those verses I read earlier, we all are dependent upon ourselves. We have to answer for what we've done with our lives. Each person is accountable for their own choices. The outcome of the parable is either they're in the party or they're not. But ultimately, we understand that this is talking about whether or not we end up in paradise or we end up in torment. So the key element of this parable, is salvation. Now, the wording of the five foolish virgins in our text is really similar to other things that we find in the book of Matthew. Matthew chapter 25, verses 11 through 12, we read, "Afterward the other virgins came, also saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he answered, 'Truly I say to you, I do not know you.'" But we don't need to go much further back in the gospel. Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 23, and kind of at the close of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' And then will I declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.'" These were people who believed in Jesus. They had done things. They had acted upon it. They had done works based upon their belief and based upon their faith. But that belief alone did not save them. It takes much more than that to be saved. Jesus here is in the passage in Matthew chapter 7, and then in our account of the parable here in Matthew chapter 25, Jesus is warning us all that there will be people who look like Christians, who associate with Christians, who even think they are Christians, but will be shocked to learn that they're not going to be able to get in, that Christ will say, "I don't know you." The text is not seeking to create uncertainty in those of us who are here this morning, but it's really seeking to warn us if we have false assurance about our lives and about our faith, if we have any doubt that we are being sincere or being prepared enough. That's what the purpose of this parable is. It's not, well, maybe it is to scare us. It's to wake us up and make us be aware that we shouldn't be complacent. In the last day, just as in Jesus' time and today, there will be those who appear to be faithful and prepared, but we'll find out that they're not. And so this parable is designed to help us understand that we need to reevaluate our preparedness at all times. And if we are lacking, we are able to do better. Now, I had mentioned there was a third group. The parable only talks about the bridegroom and those who are prepared and unprepared for the party, the group of the 10 women. Did we miss anyone in this story? Well, I'm taking a little bit of literary license here to talk about this third group. I think we can imply a third group that's not specifically mentioned in this parable. The third group is not mentioned anywhere, but I feel probably makes up the largest group of all. And those are people who are not even waiting for the bridegroom. They weren't invited. Well, not that they didn't heed the invitation, and they weren't there prepared or unprepared. They were not there. So who makes up this group? Well, I think they're just like there are two different subsets of the virgins, the wise five and the foolish five. I think there are two major subsets who make up this group of people who are not waiting. Those that know of the bridegroom, but are not convinced that he will leave anyone out. Kind of the God is a loving God. He's not going to allow anyone to go into torment. And there are those that know of the bridegroom, but think he's a myth or a fantasy, or simply just don't care to be involved with them, to have any part of their life be impacted by his existence. Many believe it matters how they live. They have the conviction that being good is important. They believe in some kind of judgment upon evil, but obviously if good people go to heaven, bad people don't. Many people then are concerned about being good. But how good is good enough? It's kind of a slippery slope. If you start going down that line of just being good, well, where how much good is not good enough? If we do many good things, maybe we've done some bad things. Have we done enough good to outweigh the bad? That's the uncertainty that comes from this kind of thinking. We can't have that. Are we supposed to just hope and guess that we've done enough good by just being good? That is the trouble. And honestly, if you get right down to it, who really consider themselves to be a bad person?
we're told, you know, even bad people treat their kids right. They give them a, you know, they give them the things they ask for, and so everybody is good in some way, but that is not what is going to get us into heaven. But I mentioned it's kind of a slippery slope. Well, we have to have a basis, and we have to understand. Went ahead of that. You kind of saw my next points, but okay. I think what we need to look at is, what does the Bible say about this? We learn about the idea of heaven from the Bible, so I think it's important that we consult the Bible to learn about what's going to get us there. Earlier, I had read that in Matthew 7, verse 21, not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven. Good people can get into heaven, but it's good people who do the will of the Father that's going to get into heaven. Before any of us get too, you know, too full of ourselves or pride and say, well, that's me, I do the will of the Father, I'm going to get into heaven. Or say, well, I've been baptized, I'm living a good life. You know, that is a mindset that'll kind of set us up to fail if we just focus on that. Being baptized isn't a get into heaven free card. Baptism, yes, is necessary, but it's not all there is. We have to still live faithfully. We have to encourage. We need to build up those that are unprepared around us, and we need to be ready to do the will of the Father until death. Now, the second group of this, I think, is mostly comprised, like you saw there, of atheists and agnostics. Now, atheism is, in a broad sense, the rejection of belief in the existence of deities. People rationalize this for not their belief in deities because they said there's a, kind of what we talked about here, you know, in our class this morning, there's a lack of empirical evidence. The problem of evil, the question of how they can reconcile the existence of evil, if God is a loving God, why would he allow this evil to take place? They also argue with inconsistent application of the Bible. When Ken Craig was here years ago and he was doing the big picture of the Bible presentation for us, I've always remembered something he said. The Bible doesn't let us down. We've let the Bible down by not being consistent with its message, meaning just people in general, not necessarily members of the church. We can only say what the Bible says, and we let the Bible down when we're not consistent in our messaging. And it asserts that it's unlikely it got, and so people who come from that standpoint, who think that the inconsistent revelations voids it all, makes it all null, they say that there are too many conflicting and mutually exclusive revelations in the Bible or how it's applied. Christians believe that Jesus is the Messiah, where Jews and Muslims don't. Muslims believe that the Quran is divinely authored, while Jews and Christians do not. And it's just even examples, even within the Bible, of contrasting views. Christianity has so many different denominations. Once again, the Bible hasn't let us down. We've let the Bible down by people building up these other denominations. And they differ greatly on many different points of doctrine. And so those who are atheists just point to that and say, well, they can't even keep themselves straight. How am I supposed to understand what I need to do? And they just choose not to. A 2015 Gallup International poll featured over 64,000 respondents, and 11% were convinced atheists. And in the 6-7 years since that was done, I'm sure that number has done nothing but go up. There is something called the rise of the 21st century atheism. It's a name given to a movement among some atheist writers who have advocated the view that religion should not simply be tolerated, but it should be countered, it should be criticized, and it should be exposed. They become very militant about their atheism. They say that any rational argument should be able to overcome this and allow it to be debunked. Some of the people that espouse this are some names that some of us are here, like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, are people that are names that I know that I'm familiar with, and some of you may be as well. And so this is something that they're becoming more out front. They're being more militant in their being against their opposition to anything about the religious world. Now, agnosticism is a view that the truth values of certain claims, especially those religious in nature, such as whether God, the divine, or the supernatural exist, they are unknown and perhaps unknowable. According to the philosopher William L. Rowe, he said, in the popular sense of the term, an agnostic is someone who neither believes nor disbelieves in God, whereas an atheist disbelieves in God. Kind of an older survey, but a 2010 survey was published that found that non-religious people or agnostics made up 9.6% of the world's population. So you add that up to the atheists, at least as of about, you know, 5-10 years ago, that group was about 20%. Once again, I just feel that that number has done nothing but grow from the time that these two surveys were conducted. Now, these groups were invited to the wedding feast, but they chose not to come and wait for the bridegroom. Despite their disbelief or their uncertainty, that won't excuse them from the day of judgment. They'll be in the same group of the foolish five, those that knew God but weren't prepared and hadn't done what they needed to do and were not allowed to enter. They will meet the same fate as those that weren't even wanting to attend and are finding themselves on the outside looking in. So where does that leave those in the world who are wise and are prepared to meet the Lord? Well, like I mentioned, our mission is to preach the gospel to those that are unprepared and those that aren't even looking. We are still obligated to try to help people that don't think they want to be helped. We can't make that decision for them, and we need to still try to reach them and help them be prepared. Maybe through the actions of members of this group of the wise, we can help some of the unwise and those that are not even looking not suffer the same fate. This parable stands as a beacon to the church in all ages. It's a witness against carelessness and just laziness towards our dedication to the faith. It also warns us against apathy and indifference. It cries to sinners that we need to be awake, and it cries to saints, you have to be alert. We try to wake up those that are not yet saved and remind those that have been saved that they need to be watching out. Now, chapter 25 begins with a call for preparedness, and it ends with a vision of what happens once it's too late to change your fate. And so I'm going to end by reading in Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on the left, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then he will answer them, saying, truly I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So we have a question that we all have to ask ourselves.
Ask yourselves right now, for sure. But ultimately, it's a question we all are going to have to come to some kind of an answer. When Jesus returns and calls us in judgment, which of these two groups do we want to find ourselves in? Do we want to find ourselves in the sheep who have done what we needed to do? We've been prepared and we've encouraged and built up those around us and we spread the gospel and we have helped those that are in need? Or do we want to be in the group that did none of this, that was not prepared, that didn't do the will of his Father, and they are unprepared and will be grouped in with the goats and will have eternal punishment? The group who has already come to Jesus and turned their life over to him and lived their life to him, they have voluntarily bowed their knee to the Lord and turned their life over to him. But we're told that on the day of judgment, every knee is going to bow and confess that the Lord, that Christ is the Lord. And I want to be among the group that's done that already. Because if we're forced to do it, it's too late. You have the opportunity now. There are those of you right here this morning that have not made that decision to be a part of the sheep. There are even those of us who have made that decision, but right now find ourselves really, we would not be lumped in with the sheep. Now is the time to make the changes in our life. Not when we're forced to at the end of the time, but now when we voluntarily can do it and we have that opportunity. The answer really seems simple. I know I want to be among the sheep. I don't want to be among the goats. It's a question we all will have to decide. And if you could look at yourself and realize that right now you'd be counted among the goats, you have an opportunity right now to start to change that. As you make that decision as we stand and as we sing.